Go.
Okay. This podcast is just a deep dive into Kerry Suda. Bottom Tudor.
It's not. Won't be very deep.
Could be. So I put it out to the group if they had any questions. I thought often you guys don't really get to know a lot about us. Well, you probably see a lot of us, like, running around our house in our underwear. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting to probably know a bit more about your coaches and what our stories are. And I thought I will interview Kerry.
Squadron is nearly 5 years old. And you're definitely older than that. So, I mean, the insight into Ali, I mean, there's almost like 8 times as much as your squad life is to dive into. And many of our athletes have only known you for a couple of years. Hmm. So,
anyway, it's your turn.
Well, okay. But
thanks for that. Right. Yeah.
We might get a brief recap, eh?
All right. So, I'm going to put a time limit on this one. In 2 minutes... tell us about your formative years, childhood experiences, things that shaped you.
The 2 minutes starts when I start talking, right? So it started already.
Yeah.
For how much have we lost?
10 seconds.
Shit. So I've got 1:50 to cover the important part. Like, start. If you're reading, am I reading my own eulogy here? Like, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today in memory of Kerry Suda.
Quick, tell us.
I grew up like most kids in New Zealand did, running around on farms. There was always huge tracts of lands. And I've got 2 older brothers. We generally were left to their own devices. Mum was always busy with enterprise. And her partner, Anne, was a Massey University DSIR research scientist. She was the first woman in the world to clone sheep. So I grew up with Mum and Anne. And... always had a lot of time and freedom. Mum just sort of left us to ourselves. So I would go on adventures, quite often take a dog, go out on the farm and explore. And we lived in on the eastern side of the Tararuas. You were on the other side, weirdly. And I used to look at the mountains and wonder what was on the other side.
That's, probably at that point I was actually in Palmy.
Well, I was in Palmy.
Well, we didn't run into each other that we know of.
Yeah, Palmas North, Shannon, Manawatu, that area was probably a lot of my life. When I was about 10, I moved to the Waikato and did intermediate and high school in Hamilton. And I was never a really particularly fit person. I think I started to get, when I was working, my professional career, I guess, started in IT in my mid-20s, and I started to sit a lot. And I wasn't, you know, I was always, prior to that, I was mucking around on, you know, garages and working on cars and that sort of thing. But I just started to spread sideways, and I got to about almost 90 kegs, and I thought I'd better do something before I won't be able to do something. Mum has always had this enthusiasm for life, almost an annoying enthusiasm for life, my mum. And I didn't want to miss out on anything. So I was concerned. I think the thought that came to me was, at some stage, I might be not fit enough or too heavy to do certain things and, you know, exercise or activity. If my mate said we were going to go up Porongia or Te Araha in the weekend, would I like to come? And if I felt like my answer was no, I don't think I could come, I think I'll slow you down, I was terrified by that thought. And I think that sort of led to the desire to do some sort of exercise. And being an IT nerd, I looked for the least amount of exercise that I could do, the laziest thing that I could do, the thing that would take the least amount of time, require the least investment. And I chose running, because you could run for 30 minutes in what you'd otherwise have to do, you know, own a bike, go to a swimming pool, or do those sorts of things. And I didn't really start running until I was about 30. And then I ran a little bit, and then I started running a lot, and heaps and heaps, and eventually got reasonably good at it. I think okay at a national level, generally sort of top tier Waikato, Bay of Plenty sort of regional stuff, and started doing a lot of running with clubs, started to understand a lot, and sort of spent about 10 or 15 years running and racing. And I guess it worked in well with my career. I could work doing IT and then escape in the lunch hour and get some meaningful training in. And I trained most days. I think I had a 927-day running streak. And it's hard. I think it's hard when you master something for 10,000 hours to be rubbish at it. So I think if anyone went out and did the same amount of training, or could, if they could absorb the amount of training that I did, I think they would achieve the exact same thing. And I think probably my coaching was born out of that, that if I can, anyone can. I was just a chubby IT guy that decided to do some running. And I don't have any special abilities that lead me towards being good at it. I just was diligent and patient. I understood that patience was important in it. And it led me to learn a lot. I nerded out about it, got a lot of books, and studied the sport. I became a good student of it. And that led me to want to help people, which I do now. I love helping people. Was that 2 minutes?
No.
Shit.
And you like ran on into my other questions, but that's cool. That saved me using my voice.
Well, you asked me like, okay.
I said childhood experiences, things that shaped you formative
years. We can start again.
No, that's all good. So
they're all formative years. Pick a non-formative year in your life.
In the previous 41 years, what sports did you play?
Football. I played heaps of footy when I was a kid. I played rep football as a kid. Mum wanted us to always do something. So competitive sport was a team sport. And I very enthusiastically played football. I was never particularly good at it. And then I took a break from it. In high school, I was good at it. In my, you know, third form. Jeez, what year? 10. I don't know, what are the years now?
Year 9.
Now? Yeah, those first few years at high school.
New Zealand, it's probably year 8, Australia, I think. Yeah.
And then I didn't like how it became, you know, like the pressure of, you know, making the first 11 and those sorts of things. So I didn't, I got out of it and didn't enjoy it until after high school, until I joined a social football club and I played a lot. And I found that I felt like I was the first person to get to the ball to trip over it, to muck it up or make a mistake. And I was always quick, like I was playing it like always down the wing or something like that. And I loved it, but I had really bad ankles and I didn't understand anything about shoes or footwear. And I kept rolling my ankles. I kept getting injured. And it got to the point where I was getting injured so much from rolling my ankles in the footy season, I couldn't play. So I'd run a bit and I was running more than I was playing football. So I guess that kind of led into that was the segue into running, was probably the football and the training. The not being able to play football led to running.
Was it also because I always say Kerry doesn't team good? Did the team thing come into it?
Oh man, I hate team sports and I love team sports. I love that, you know, you rise above yourself. It's 100% you, but it's also, you know, like it's extra percents for everyone else. So you're 110% committed to everything because you're working not just for your own result, but for everyone else's. So you try so hard. And we do that in road running. We do, you know, when we do relays and stuff. But the frustrating thing, the opposite end of that, I think, is that you see people on your team that aren't putting in the effort that you're putting in. And, I remember a couple of goalies that I had that were just, they just didn't give a shit. You know, the ball would just roll on past them. They'd be like, oh. And they'd make some snide comment like it got past 10 of us to get to him. So we were
Which is true.
You play better teams, you play worse teams, all sorts of things happen. But, you know, you see people just not putting in the same effort as you. And I found that really frustrating, and I didn't respond to it. Actually, from it came wanting to do single sports that weren't competitive, you know, like running for running's sake and surfing because it wasn't a competitive sport. It was just things you could do on your own.
So, aside from running, what things are you into?
Used to be, you know, cars used to be a really big thing for me. I used to spend a lot of my time underneath, you know, various Fords, old Fords. I've still got a 1965 Cortina that desperately needs to be rehomed and finished. So there's always been a bit of a hobby and an interest. There was a decade where I was married and, you know, I have kids and there's a lot of renovating and trying to get a head in, you know, the small amount of personal time that you have when you're a dad. So it's funny because I've been off the tools for so long, but it was such a big part of my life that every weekend was, you know, building decks or fences or renovating, and I, you know, did the usual Kiwi thing and flip some houses, and I did that sort of thing. That's more out of necessity, but than passion. You know, I don't think a lot of people genuinely love the fact that they've got to go and demo a kitchen and put a new kitchen, and they just realize it's a necessity. But that was a big chunk of my life, and obviously being a dad as well. That, you know, my girls are 8 and 10, and I haven't been able to see them since lockdown, and they're in a separate bubble far away. And we spend a bit of time chatting online, but that's probably the other passion and pursuit is those kids are there. And then of course there's this thing now, coaching. I love being able to help people, and I love that I get to do it with my favorite person in the whole world. That Ali and I see the world we assimilate the world in the same way.
Similarly, you know, we're like a pair of elephants. Okay, what got you into coaching?
When I was performing well in races, generally not so much club races, but when I was performing well in, like, you know, trail races. This is kind of almost before the whole ultra marathon scene. This would be in sort of the 2006, 2007. People would contact me and ask for my ideas on what they can do to be a better athlete. And I knew a bit, but wasn't a teacher. So I was hesitant to do anything. I don't like instructing if I haven't got the qualifications to back it up. I don't know whether it's the imposter syndrome thing coming through, or just, you know, having that validity. Just being good at something doesn't mean that you're qualified to teach others to do it. I understood what it took for me to get good, and I think probably the evolution of my coaching has been that just doing what I did doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if everyone follows the same path, they'll get the same result. So the desire to help people really was what got me into coaching, and finding the middle ground, you know, like as a professional coach, somebody gets paid, is really about having some skin in the game. You know, me wanting to do a good job for my athletes because they're paying me for it, and them wanting to do something good with the work that I give them because they're paying for it. So that in terms of a professional coach, I think has led us to this point. That and you forcing me to get heavily qualified as well.
This one was from I think it was Sally. Do you have a mission statement for Squadrun?
I really do, and I don't know whether you agree with it, Ali, but I honestly at the very beginning was like, how can I help as many people as possible? It came from Squadrun was born out of a nationwide seminar tour that we were doing with Paul and Tim and Craig Kirkwood, and I was coaching something like 8 to 10 people, and CK's books were full. I didn't have any more capacity to help people, and I realized in these seminars there were rooms of people that wanted more information and more support and more help, and I couldn't help them as privately coached athletes. So it really came out of, how do I help more people? And it started with a very complicated spreadsheet, and we did that, I think, in about late July 2015, maybe 2015. And then I think from that it was born into more complex SQL databases and various other things. But it was, if the mission statement was anything, it is, you know, my view is that it is to help as many people as possible.
Yeah, and my one was to bring people together, because running's quite a solo sport, so.
And in the darkness, bind them.
But other than that, basically it's don't be a dick, right? Like,
that's that mission statement, don't be a dick.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, it's mostly just about having fun and enjoying your running.
Obviously that's coming. It's the next interview episode is Ali Pottinger on.
Curious to see because we haven't really sat down and created a joint mission statement, I don't think. I mean, there's information on our Facebook pages, but it's interesting to see.
Yeah.
Mission statement sounds hardcore.
What did Google have was Do No Evil or something, right? And then they sort of scrapped that when they started doing some military projects.
Well, but also you associate the words that you're using with them. So that's not really positively framed wording.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, next question. There's a few here. Should we do a quick fire round? Yeah, let's do that. Quick fire, you just have to answer. No other words apart from your answer, okay? Can you do that?
Nope.
Folder or scruncher?
Ah, folder. I know what we're talking about. Folder.
Toenails, leave or pull?
Pull. Pliers.
Kerry and Tiger King.
Haven't seen it. Aware of the memes. I ain't nobody got time for that.
Do you sleep?
Yes. Well, pretty well. You nap better than I do. You're a better napper.
Oh, God, no. All right. That's the quick fire rundown.
That was good.
That round done for now. Tell us about your reality TV infamy.
I got loaded one night at a mate's place, and then I came home and was playing Kingdom of Loathing online, and it's an online Java game. It's kind of weird. You can just look at it. It's weird. Nari might like it. It's KOL. Kingdom of Loathing. Anyway, I was pretty boozed, and I know this retrospectively. I don't know that I did it at the time, but an ad came on TV to go somewhere and fill out some online form, and I did it. And didn't realize I'd done it. And 6 weeks later, I was at work, and I got a phone call to say that it had 3,500 applicants, and that mine was in the final 100 or so. And I said, "What applicants? What have I done?" And they're like, "You filled out a form to be on an online reality TV show." And I asked them to send through what I had filled out, because I had no memory of doing it, and because it was one of those nights. And so I had a laugh at what I'd filled out, and realized that I probably cast myself in that scenario. They then asked for a video to be sent to them. Fortunately, I've got some people that work in professional production, so they put together a really tidy sort of interview thing with me, and I went from the final, from 3,500 people or something to 30 people that were selected to do this challenge. And obviously it was a social engineering challenge where you try and pit people that won't like each other against one another in a small confined place until they want to kill each other. Fortunately, they didn't make food an issue, so food was ample and bountiful, but we were near Arthur's Pass in tents. And it was the show itself, the format for the show was great. The cinematography was excellent. It was really high budget for the time. Everything was high def, which was rare. It was bought by TV3 for millions of dollars. But no one watched it because the editing was just horrendous. It was unwatchably bad because they just destroyed it in the edit suite. And basically it was kind of like a Survivor thing, but with outdoor challenges. So there was like rafting and mountain biking and caving and canyons and, you know, various things. And it was well set up with two teams and the process of, you know, team competition and then individual elimination challenges. And I tell you, when you're doing a one-on-one challenge with someone else, and it, you know, it feels life or death. You know, the person that loses the challenge in the moment, you know, they're off, they're out. And head-to-head stuff like that is genuinely savage and high pressure. And it was the most pressure I've ever been in my life. I remember lying in my tent at night just bawling my eyes out because of the pressure of the whole situation. I was boxed at all times. Everyone was trying to take me out of the game. And, you know, like verbally talking through, you know, strategy and things like that made people think that I was, some evil, conniving character, but I was just trying to unpackage the situation we were in and compete. And I managed to dodge and weave and zig and zag and get my way to the end. And I think, you know, realistically, out of the 30 people that were there, I was, in terms of the environment, you know, like being in the wilderness in the Southern Alps, it suited me better than it suited a bunch of Aucklanders that were in no situation, they were no preparedness to be out there. So we managed to, the final challenges were up glaciers and up mountains and Mount Tasman, you know, really genuinely high stuff, snow and ice and, you know, crampons. And endurance cardiovascular fitness one through in the end. And I remember someone saying to me, I was running at the time, training in base camp, just running up and down. I had a 100-meter stretch that I could exercise on, and I would do 10Ks just running 100-meter shuttles. And they were like, you can do all the exercise you want, we're just going to vote you off. And I was like, well, you know, that's what I can't control, but what I can control is my fitness. So I managed to maintain that for 6.5 weeks. For a 10-week show that I somehow won a car, sold it immediately, a Holden Adventurer. And I feel like I had PTSD from that for years. I had trouble sleeping, and it was genuinely the most challenging part of my life. But that's my reality TV story.
Yeah, and you're also a game player. Like, you've been a gamer, so you would totally gamify that situation and plot through all of the situations and steps. And
I remember a couple of clueless people having a go at me one time on my team, and they were absolutely traumatized that I dared come up with some sort of a strategy that involved capable players bonding together to have some sort of advantage. And they were like, well, I can't believe you've done that. I'm like, it's a game where there's going to be winners and losers. It's like Monopoly. You don't just randomly roll the dice and make no intellectual decisions. You play to win, and there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And when you land on Mayfair or Parkland and you're bankrupt, you know, hard cheese, you're out. You've got to play.
Kerry can be pretty ruthless when we play games.
You too. I would not have wanted to be on the summit with you. You are a competitive schnitbag, and it would have brought out an ugly side of you. It really would have.
It would have depended which team you're on.
Correct.
Okay, so James had a real list of questions. This is pretty cool. So he said, this is what inspires me about Kerry. I can recall him posting a few years ago an old YouTube clip from a TV program where he won its grand final by climbing some snow-covered mountain, and he won a car. I can remember thinking that day, wowzers, this cat can play. Yeah, you're right, James, he plays. When he turns up, he's on. I love this. Since then, I've learned he has won Tarawera 100 twice and Gao 100. He obviously has that killer edge in battle, and I always find anyone that has it super inspiring. Anyway, what other big achievements has Kerry had over his journey in the sporting arena, particularly endurance feats?
It's funny, you know, when I won the Tarawera's, and you know, like Gao's another example. Like, I would never have looked at my running CV and thought that those were the shiny diamonds, the pinnacle of my, you know, fitness. I did, like.
Okay, well, what were the shiny diamonds then?
You got to look at, you know, like, so PB. So you take, like, 10K in under 32 minutes. It's like 308s. Hold 308s for 10K and not blow to bits. Like, I don't think that I ran, you know, all of my best times that I was capable of. But, you know, like a low 15 pass for 5K, 71 minutes for a half marathon. You know, the sorts of things that you do that, you know, you feel like you're winning a pissing competition, or at least, you know, like competing in it. You know, winning trail races at the time were like, at the time they were a joke. You know, the people that were training and racing, it was all club scene. You know, people were trying to run 220 marathons and stuff. And if you went out on the trails, it was you know, recreational at best. Occasionally, you would get other capable people in your races, but I always thought, getting back to that competitive thing, the one person I didn't want to race above all was myself, because I would do anything to win. And I knew if there was a clone of me, that I would cut me to win. And it would be savage, and I'd, you know, like a mind games, I'd climb inside my own head. Like, I remember racing other capable people at times in trail races, and I would really break it down. You know, like, I'd write, you know, how to beat certain athletes. I knew some athletes in and out, and when I was going to stand on the line with them, what I needed to do to beat that person. And you know, if it's a road race, it's pretty easy. You just got to hold decent splits. You just got to run the best that you can, for the most part, and the fittest person will come out on top. But for a trail run, there's so much more to it. You know, like, it's, do you hold back and attack them late, or do you play your strength hand, you know, early and try and get a lead that they can't, you know, that you can defend or they can't match. I liked the serious competitiveness of it, but it leads you at a cul-de-sac of competition, because eventually you're not going to be the best, and eventually you aren't going to win everything. And at some point, you know, what do you do when you're not you know, Macca, if you're not the competitive triathlete or professional triathlete, what is life after competitive sport for, you know, pseudo professionalism, you know, like effectively going out to try and win a lot of stuff. I feel like the sun set on my formative trail running and ultra career before it really ramped up to be something great. I never got to cross swords with Vajan Armstrong. You know, I always wanted to go to Kepler and, you know, win it or podium, and I always thought it'd be around the corner. But one day you're getting better, and then one day you're not, and you know, you're climbing a mountain and improving, and then at some stage you go off the other side, and I won't run my PBs for 5k anymore or 10k anymore, and I have to be okay with that. So I forgot, have I gone away from the question now?
Oh no, it's kind of where James was heading, but I want to know why you think that you don't have fast times or wins ahead of you now.
I knew when I was racing in my early 30s that I was racing really good guys in the early 40s, where I am now, you know, Colin Ewacker and, you know, Glenn Sexton and the guys that were running. So they'd run toys in 124, right? So that's enough to win it. 124, would you beat Sam Clark, who won 124 for toys? But so I'm that age now, and I could probably do it again if I wanted to go out and do it. But you know what? The carrot on the stick isn't big enough. The training journey for me isn't rewarding like it used to be, and the results don't inspire me as much as they used to. So even if I set a target of, say, you know, perform really well at Tuttawira 100K, even if I define that as finishing, say, top 10 or under 10 hours and trained towards it, you know, like it just doesn't light my fire anymore. I feel like I look at it and I go like, you know, I achieved a lot for a chubby IT guy, more than I ever thought that I was going to achieve, certainly. But I don't feel like I have anything, you know, undone that I really would want to go back for. And the training process that I know that I would need to go through, it brings me a lot more pain now. Just going out and doing the mileage, you know, my Achilles are on fire if I'm trying to run 100K weeks, and I know I'd want to. And if I try to run, you know, some high tempo stuff, the hill reps and the intervals and those sorts of things, they, you know, it would hurt for me to walk, and I'm not in pain now, and I'm enjoying that I can recreationally do something, and that's a healthy place for me to be with it now.
Okay. With regards to that last kind of the question, what do you think your greatest endurance feat has been that brings back the most pride and special memories?
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have like a medal rack. You know, I mean, I'm not the sort of person to like.
No, but inside, trophies and. We know that, but what is your moment that you are really proud of?
I've enjoyed the ability to do. I feel like my fitness is an enabler for me to have experience, have genuinely really cool experiences. To, like I talked about, not missing out on going out with my mates and climbing mountains. Well, that became endurance feats. You know, I think that my Man Alone mission was something, I mean, it's more recent, but I love that I, you know, really challenged myself. I was out there on my own for a very long time, and I did something that was really big and really scary. And I remember probably all of the really big missions. I felt like those tested me the most. And I think in those darkest moments when you find yourself, when you're really battered, that you, you know, you consolidate that understanding of yourself. You know, do you remember after the Blue Lake 24-hour challenge when I was just so wrecked and I couldn't even string a sentence together? You know, I remember those moments, and I'm like, you know, whoop-de-doo, you ran 100 miles and under 24 hours at the Blue Lake, and, you know, it was 21 hours or something. It wasn't even a fast 100 miles, but it was, I hadn't done one before, and maybe those sorts of things, when you do the unknown, and it really tests, you get a real check, you know, like, shit's hard, and you push yourself and you overcome it. The greatest memories, like the three peaks that I did out the back of Katoomba with Nathan
mm-hmm.
and Tony.
Yeah.
Those sorts of challenges.
Yeah, so they're not time related and they change over time.
Right, I set my own goals, I think. Those have been the ones that have been most rewarding for me.
So have you got any future solo adventures like this that you are looking to do?
I wonder whether I'm mountain biking a bit more now, and I wonder whether maybe I'll come up with something from a mountain biking perspective that might capture my imagination. I do a lot of hiking with my brother, and some of that is genuinely really grunty and, you know, physically challenging and, you know, remote and tough. And it's a lot of fun, but maybe it's not what it used to be. And maybe just running for really long periods of time isn't what it used to be. You know, like the Skorman to Kaitoki and the Tararuas. Do I want to go back and do under 24 hours? All of these sort of things just float around. There isn't one defined goal that I really want to do. And I talked about maybe trying to swim across all of the lakes and run a circuit of, you know, the seven Greater Lakes in Rotorua. But that, you know, that's a pretty big challenge. Something will form, I think, and then I'll probably just set out to do it. I'd quite like to try and bike every trail in the Whaka Forest. That'd be kind of neat. Or at least do, you know, like realistically the grade four and below trails, because I'm not a pilot yet, so I don't want to get launched. But something like that, or maybe even just like trying to do all of the grade four and below challenge, you know, trails non-stop. Or something like that. I really like the thought of going out there and doing, you know, just creating something and going out and knocking it off. If someone put together a really decent map of something, maybe the length of the Ruahinis, what happens is these things get planted in my mind and eventually I have to go and do them. The Three Peaks in Tongariro, that sounds like a lot of fun. Start at the Chateau, do Tongariro, Narohoi and Ruapehu, and then come back to the Chateau. And the other challenge I'd quite like to do is surf to summit. Start in Whanganui, go up the Whanganui River Road to the top of the hill and finish at the summit of Ruapehu. There.
Sorry, I'm just giggling because I've had a few more questions come in. I just thought I'll look at Facebook. And we were just talking earlier about Steve Wadham not being part of, not having any stories for our last podcast. But he's got some questions for you.
Oh, these will be good. Here we go.
So his question is, one of them, what does it feel like to win a big race?
God, I can't remember.
It wasn't big when you won it.
None of it, yeah. Good one. Was that a joke? Was that... You dick. What a dick. What would be the most prestigious thing I've won? Like, in terms of, like, what mattered at the time? None of it. It's all shit. No one gives a shit. No one cares. I don't care anyway. I can't remember. What does it feel like to win a big race? I actually really liked winning the Carry 70.
Oh yeah, okay.
Three times I won that, I think. Because I think that meant a lot for me. I think that run has a bit of mana and it has a special place in my heart. And I raced guys that were pretty good. Dennis DeMonchi was pretty fit when we raced. Mm-hmm. So I think more than crowds of thousands of people, it was just that it meant a lot to do, yeah, to win those sorts of races.
Oh, this is a tough one. Is the cutoff for Tarawera excessive, being that you can literally walk 160k in 36 hours? Do you think it cheapens the achievement?
Oh, that's a weird one. Do I have an opinion? You got to slot yourself into the goal or into the race, right? So for me, my race at Tarawera wouldn't be about cutoffs. So, I mean, I don't give a shit about what's happening in the back of the field in terms of my own personal experience with the race. But if you are an aspiring athlete, I can definitely understand that you would want to probably, you know, it's an enabler. They've set the safety net. The trail races are really ways that we can get out and do this epic stuff on the trails with a safety net of aid stations and medical crews and a bit of bling at the end and some fanfare when you finish, and the structure, it lets you could go and do these things on your own anytime you want, but with no cutoff time. But to do it and to be considered part of the club that completed it, make them, I encourage event directors to make them anything they want to make them. It's their game, it's their rules.
Yeah, they're the ones that have to deal with it.
Right, does free parking, yeah. Do you get money on free parking or not? I mean, technically the rules say you don't, but everyone's chucking the taxes in there. Fucking taxes.
Okay, here's Steve's last question. Do you worry that some ultra runners attach their whole identity to running and becoming, for instance, Kerry the Mad Runner rather than Kerry the father, partner, or friend?
Really, it's more a highlight of some mental health stuff, I think, in that scenario. If people are so one-dimensional that's all there is to their personality, to themselves, then they're probably hanging on to it, and they are that one-dimensional, potentially because they don't have enough depth in their life or can't find it, or they seek something from that running, that they're getting something from it.
I guess too, there is the whole community around running though, so that is the way that you are known.
But you aren't just that. Even if you look at the elite athletes that we know, that it's a huge part of their personality, but it's not all of their personality. No. Debo will sit here and talk to you about lacrosse, or he loves NFL. He's multifaceted. I think most of the top athletes, they actually are. You only see them at face value on Instagram, pumping out running inspo. But generally, they're all pretty multifaceted. You're more likely to see people, spamming Facebook groups with, pictures of where they've run, and that's all there is to their life. And potentially those are the ones that when you look at it, you go, yeah, but is there anything else to this person? Potentially those are the ones that probably are at that one-dimensional.
Well, I guess it's just what makes them feel good. But it is easy to get caught up in overwhelmed with just running, because especially with the endurance stuff, it is such a long, you dedicate a lot of time to training. Eat, and sleep, to running run, and repeat.
Do very little else. When I was training 100 mile weeks, that was it. There was very little time capacity for much else. Good question, Steve.
Okay. Jonathan Ennis King, also, what's the hardest part of being a coach and what's the best part?
Good one. The best part is it's kind of like a working for yourself scenario where, our hours are somewhat flexible. We commit to being places for our athletes and seeing our athletes and spending as much time as we can with them. That the best part is all the friendships that we have made, I think. There's so many beautiful people in our life that, like I commented the other day, we would be in the Blue Mountains hanging out with our, Blue Mountains family and having Sunday roast at the Douglases, or, seeing the kids and what they're all up to, or, catching up in Sydney with Pei or Nairi, or, all of our extended family. I love that about what we do. We're so lucky we have like 400 or 500 good friends, and that generally, for the most part, everyone's welcome. I love catching up with people at training camps. Remember how good Old Ghost training camp was in December?
Yeah.
Like, that was such a cool group of people. Eddie, Sarah. Like, we had so much fun just mucking around.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love the relationship side of it. I mean, that, and it's echoed through our sport, isn't it? Because we always talk about how lucky we are as trail runners, that our community is, like, our vibe is so cool, that it's bunch of really good like-minded people, and they're kind and caring and loving people. So that's what I love about that. It really just, that's what I do for a job. I live in people's recreation space when they're doing their fun thing. I'm there and I'm part of it. I've helped create it, or I'm there to see them finish it. And probably the worst thing is the I guess it's a little bit of victim of our own success at times, is that the workload for us is overwhelming and can be really beats us down, and sometimes you want to just close the laptop at 10 p.m. and go to bed crying because you're starting first thing in the morning and you're after it. It's tough.
You're such a drama queen.
But when it is bad, it's bad, right? Like, it's the and you suffer it too, right? It manifests itself in other ways for you. Become a bit shirty, and I have to hide the corn chips, and
God. Okay, here's a serious question from Phil Sale. What is the perfect angle and holding technique for a nutsack landscape shot?
It's way harder than you might think. And I think Phil, now here's the thing, is I think Phil is commenting because he's tried and he's gone, this is not as easy as I thought it would be. Is that right, Phil? You tell me I'm right, buddy. You, with the, it's anyone who hasn't tried a nutshot or some flapscaping, get out there and have a crack. Ah, good one.
Oh my gosh.
It's way tougher than you think it is. It is difficult, Phil, but yeah. It's actually a much bigger squat than you think because the lens on these cameras are so wide, right? You've got to get your knees like almost like sideways, and then you've got to really get low like a widescreen TV is what you're creating. You've got to think about what a laptop screen looks like, and that's the shape you're making with your legs.
Wow, you've really put a lot of thought into
that. That's really what's happening. And then you've got to cut the sausage and somehow get the maracas in play. And all of it.
Okay.
It's
yeah.
difficult.
I feel like you've imparted some good coaching advice there.
Right.
I'm
a pro.
Okay. What do you eat or drink that warrants those incredible ass acoustics? That's from Maria Kronenberg.
Ah, well, yeah, we discussed this. I have a fairly high fiber diet, but I tell you, if my food bags actually made things a little bit windier. I think there's a more varied things. Like you said, there's a lot more things in the meals than we would normally cook, right? So,
there's a lot of ingredients to them, yeah.
I think when you do that, when you have a lot more things, a lot more colours and a lot more, you know, like 30 or 40 vegetables in your week, you're more likely to get the gut biome scaling up in a gaseous kind of a way, which has led to a net increase in my farming. But also, you know, those squad wads are happening at a high fiber time of my day when I normally do two or three poops because of the amount of coffee I'm drinking. So that's, sorry, Maria. It's everyone who does those.
Especially me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jane O'Dwyer, food is always interesting. Have you gone full vegan? What's your top everyday foods and training food?
Great. Great question. You know, I was thinking just earlier today, how many people started to be plant-based on the back of Game Changers and how quiet they got, because many of them lasted less than a week. But I think I'm a year and a half now, I guess, plant-based.
Yeah.
And certain things have been really easy, like the meat and chicken and all of that sort of stuff, the process is all gone. The dairy's a little bit harder. You know, it's easy. I don't have any milk, really don't have any cheese.
Like, but you do have fish.
I have fish, yeah. So not full vegan, and the veganism actually goes a little bit far in some regards in my opinion, because I'm in it for health and well-being purposes. I look at it as having an environmental tier, a health and well-being tier, an animal welfare tier, and really of the three, the one I'm most interested in my response to training, which is why I try to eat quite clean. But I do occasionally have fish. Less so now. I would probably have one fish meal every 10 to 14 days, probably like less than one a week. Definitely less than one a week. And otherwise, it's, I would say it's vegan, because there's nothing else, no dairy and no meat. Yeah, I don't think I have any other mulligans. Pretty good on it. And it's really, and like I say, the reason why I have I'm not a full vegan is because the longevity research shows in the blue zones that most of those diets have a little bit of fish. They have no meat, but a little bit of fish. So, again, health and well-being would say that you should probably get a little bit. So, I do.
So, what are your top everyday foods in training food?
Man, I wish I was better with beans and legumes, but I'm not great, but I'm better than I used to be. And I love cruciferous veg. So, if I try and get my broccolis and cauliflower. I love a good cabbage. But every day we're pretty varied, but pretty good. I try not to do any one thing for a long period of time. So like most people, I go through a phase of toast and then a phase of cereal and then a phase of no breakfasts. But we're pretty varied. I think we're pretty good with our foods. It's when we're traveling, we eat shit.
Have a penchant for hot chips.
You have a penchant for going out every night.
Because I'm party girl.
If I could eat one thing forever, it'd probably be fish wraps. I love wraps. If you can just take salad ingredients and roll it up in a bread thing and then occasionally put fish in it, that'd be me. Sometimes beans, but yeah, wraps. Love them. Crunchy things, iceberg lettuce.
James had a good one. He said, name who you would say is New Zealand's greatest ever endurance athlete. Not necessarily running, but if not a runner, then include a runner in the answer also, please. Endurance athlete.
Nathan Fave.
Really? That was pretty decisive. Why?
He's at a relatively competitive level in that history of multi-sport and endurance racing, and he continues to perform well for what has been a very long time. I don't think that the multi-sporters, Richard Usher was pretty good. I think Richard of the you know, coast to coast athletes, mm-hmm. Richard Usher is, I think, definitely better than Sam Clark and better than controversial than Steve Gurney.
Mm-hmm.
I raced Richard a few times with club events, and mm-hmm. we would run again like 32 minutes for 10K. So there's a guy who's hauling out on the road, and I mean, that's all I was doing was running, and he was doing that and all sorts of other things. So Richard Usher's up there, but Nathan Fave, you know, unquestionably has, you know, had been at the top of his game for a very long period of time for extreme endurance. We're talking like days of exercise. I would like to have said that there's a female that would have sprung to mind there, but and I would happily go either way on that, but in terms of outright endurance, yeah.
Okay. Does he count as a runner? I guess he does.
Jack Foster, if I was to say a runner, Foster was pretty incredible. Jack Foster's 2:17 at Rotorua is pretty amazing, and I know we've had faster marathons run, but Jack Foster was just an incredible, well-rounded athlete. And had we ever gone to endurance, you know, ultra-marathon type stuff, we would have seen probably some of those old those old hands would have been incredibly good at it, and probably people like Jack Foster would have been one of the best in the world, no question. Jonathan Wyatt! Shit, I take it all back, Jonathan Wyatt. And if you don't know, Google. So
yeah, or ask Fleur, she'll tell you.
Shit, just named three guys and no woman. It's shit.
Yeah, awesome, oh, Kerry. Well, who do you think is the best endurance, greatest ever endurance athlete in the world?
World.
The whole world.
Let's just, can I refine it to just running, because there's so many different sports out there. But Jim's hard to beat at the moment. Jim's at a pretty crazy level, but then, you know, would you say Killian? Courtney? Camille's run? You know, we're talking world records are getting broken now.
Yeah.
Yanis Kurov? Bruce Fordyce? There's been, like, the history of running is deep. And I guess you'd get into cycling as well. I mean, those are probably the two biggest endurance sports.
Okay. I think we're going to get close to wrapping it up. I've got two more questions. If you could influence people, what would you like your influence to be?
You know how we've got this R-naught with the virus infecting, you know, one sick person, you know, will make, you know, like two or three other people sick?
Okay, yeah.
Right, I wish we had a running R-naught where one runner would inspire two others to get out on the trails. Like, I wish, we do in some regard, but it's very hard to measure. And I would love more people, I would love those who are already doing it and that are capable of it to be able to share the experience in a way that other people can have those moments as well, that they can be out on Toys Track with you and go, holy shit, I just had no idea that it, you know, that this experience can be this good. And I wish that we could get, you know, those couch to 5K people. There's so many people out there. I feel like I was one. I couldn't run 2Ks, you know, like I was a couch to 5K person. You would, we all started somewhere. It's just, I see it in people starting out on the journey, and they're, it's cool seeing them make their little discoveries. Like, you know, Animator ran his first 21K run the other day, and I thought that was really cool to see him do that. And I had nothing to do with it. He just, I guess he knew it was possible, because if I can, anyone can, right? So I would love to see our R-naught of running to be at 3, and I'd love real people to go out and get, just collar them, just drag them out there.
Okay. I've just had two more questions come in, so I'll ask this one and then the last two from Jonathan. What's one thing that you're looking forward to about the future?
I'm really excited to see how this will all play out in the longer term. I don't know that we will be doing Big Hero events in the same format. I think that the environment that we're in is really changeable and will change. And I don't know that in the next 12 to 18 months, we're going to stand on a start line with thousands of people. And I think that we will want to do something as athletes, and that events will adapt to create something for us. So I feel like we're on the cusp of creation, and that excites me, that from this will come new formats for us to do our thing. And I'm looking forward to what shape they take, virtual runs or separate, you know, group runs. We could all get out to the Blue Lake and put tents all the way around it and social distance ourselves for 24 hours and not be drinking from the same punch bowl but still doing the 24-hour thing. You know, there's all sorts of things. The way I think people are just going to discover new avenues to take this down, and I'm looking forward to seeing what that is. One thing is always for certain, though, there's always going to be runners and there's always going to be coaches, so we just remain adaptable, I guess.
And to wrap up, Jonathan has asked Inneskin? A very dangerous question.
Sorry, Jonathan Inneskin?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What are the best and worst parts about being in a bubble with me? You might not be in it any longer if it's too bad.
The worst parts. Should we start with the worst parts?
Yes.
Oh, you're such a killjoy. Like you don't let me fly free. I would break all the rules, and I would create my own justification as to why I believe it's okay for me to do all of those things.
Yeah.
And I would just. Yeah, like I would be running around in the forest butt naked all hours, just being in a complete loon, and you are like, don't do that, don't be that, you're not meant to be doing that. So, you know, you're like the rules Nazi.
Yes.
I need it, but I don't like it.
Yeah.
Get it?
Yeah, and I don't like trying to...
This isn't about you, rules. Ellie. This is my question.
Okay. What do you like about...
I'm not finished yet. I want to go on more about...
I think that's probably enough.
Is it? Okay. I've actually had the best time with you for the last 2 weeks. This has been, and we laugh and say we're living our best life, but we're home and we're spending heaps of time together, and I can see this being a thing. Like we, no.
Do you mean,
we're constantly
together like
we're a while. Yeah, but we're so busy, you know, out there working, you know, delivering, traveling. It's like, it's not, there's no normality to it. It's constant chaos. And I know it works in the chaos, but now with the chaos removed, we have, you know, what ordinary people would see as an ordinary life where, you know, we're in our own bed every night.
A different kind of chaos.
Right. But like, our relationship's really good for it. I think that, you know, like, I'm seeing that, you know, I don't dislike you as much as I thought I would. So that's been really encouraging. Hey.
Wow.
You know, it's a good times, good laughs. We laugh every day.
Yeah.
Right? We get on really well. There haven't been any, like, major bust-ups. Oh, there's just a few major bust-ups. Yeah, that's right. You're being a dick.
Oh, God.
So, but we've done really well, I think, considering we've lived in each other's pockets. It's not been fighty. It's been really positive.
We always live in each other's pockets anyway.
But it's like, it's been really positive and healthy, and that's really good. I mean, we've been together for ages, and I could definitely be bored of you by now. But I'm not. I still like you, which is cool. And I like that.
Okay.
There's a little time capsule moment.
I feel like we should finish with something else, Kerry.
What?
What personality? Which personality trait are you most proud of in yourself?
Who asked that?
Me.
Oh. Enthusiasm, optimism, those two, they are the same thing. And the English language doesn't do well at isolating. We don't need to isolate that emotion. I am generally really optimistic and enthusiastic about things. So I see the best in stuff and make the best of situations that I can. And I'm really happy that I have that outlook as opposed to a negative one. I think what came from my father's death was that mum ingrained in us the importance of being really positive and not, you know, dwelling on the sadness or, but succumbing to mental health problems. I think I managed to naively get away with them by just being optimistic and enthusiastic about everything.
I feel like on that note, we should finish with your favourite catchphrase. I'll survive. I hope you do too.
That is definitely what I say. I'll survive. I hope you do too. You know, one day that won't be true. And I keep thinking, I'll be like, yeah, well, I tried. That's generally how it goes. I'll survive. I hope you do too. Thanks, everyone. Ellie's up next.
Oi.
Peace.